The temperatures and humidity may be climbing, but the tourism business in South Florida continues heating up, becoming a year-round industry. Visitors come here by the car, plane, and cruise boat full to bask in our sun, our sand, and yes, get sunburned. 1 million jobs in our state depend upon the billions of dollars visitors leave behind each year. Business that is more competitive and is always price conscious. I'm Tom Hudson. Coming up on the Sunshine Economy, selling paradise, tourism in South Florida. From international travelers to our fellow Floridians, travelers are keeping tourism businesses busy. But for locals, are the traffic jams and crowds worth it? It's the Sunshine Economy, and it's next on WLRN.
This is the story of a visit to a land that knows no winter, the land where the sun reigns.
50 years ago, this was the sound of a growing industry. A half century later, and the promise of Miami and South Florida to visitors is much the same. That promise is the sun, the sand, and the surf. But as the tourism industry has grown, so has its importance to our region. The numbers are awfully impressive. More than 1 million jobs statewide, more than 26 million visitors in just the first 3 months of this year. This is the Sunshine Economy, selling paradise, tourism in South Florida.
Greater Miami, Dade County.
Another edition here of the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Welcome to the program. Now, if you think about it, we outsource about 10% of our economy. 10% of Florida's economy depends upon people who don't live here, people who just visit. Just how important are tourists to fueling Florida's economic recovery? Well, the job growth in the hospitality industry far exceeds job growth in every other major industry here in the state of Florida since the Great Recession. Think about that. There are more people now working in the travel industry today than ever before. That's why we're talking about selling paradise tourism in South Florida here on the Sunshine Economy. Join the conversation online at WLRN.org and on Twitter with the handle WLRN. Use the hashtag the Sunshine Economy. And do us a favor, answer the question, how do you know you've seen a tourist in South Florida? We'll have more on that coming up. So we begin where about half of the visits to South Florida begin. Behind the wheel of a car, looking at our world through a windshield, on the way to where tourism's industry began here in South Florida. I'm driving eastbound now on Okeechobee, just beginning to cross the drawbridge that crosses over the intercoastal waterway as we move eastbound from West Palm Beach into Palm Beach. Okeechobee gets renamed Royal Palm Way here as we begin to enter Palm Beach, arguably where modern tourism really began for South Florida back in 1896 when Henry Flagler brought the railroad down and built the first of what ultimately were three versions of the breakers. The first two burnt down. The third still stands today. So just a couple blocks to my right is Worth Avenue and all those high-end retailers. Up and down Royal Palm Way here are some of the big banking names in the world of financial services that helps give Palm Beach kind of its reputation as a playground for the well-off, playground of the 1%. Well-groomed lawns, the towering palm trees over the roadway here as we begin our way toward County Road to turn north into the Breakers area. You know, it's a beautiful kind of postcard day here for Palm Beach. Florida blue sunshine, about 81 degrees here in the late morning, slight breeze off the ocean. Real beautiful day for visitors and for natives alike, for that matter. Begin our way here northbound on County Road as we begin to make our way closer to the breakers, traveling north on A1A. Flagler built the breakers and opened it up in 1896 as a getaway for him and his rich friends from the north and northeast. Really is still the kind of the grand hotel in Palm Beach, certainly. It remains a bit of a bellwether for South Florida tourism. Here we are, we make a right into the breakers entrance, and you're greeted by this really grand picture of this magnificent hotel, the Italian Renaissance style. Come up to a circle here, and we'll check in at the gate. Hi there, thank you. Yeah, I've got a meeting.
Fantastic.
Great.
Straight ahead to the Inn for Valet.
Okay, marvelous. Thank you so much.
Have a good day.
You too. Continue on this brick-paved driveway lined with these really magnificent palms up to the large fountain in the front, and then, of course, the breakers trying to appear and appeal as much as it did back more than 100 years ago when Flagler put it together. Pull up to the valet, take full advantage of all the amenities while we're here. Why not, after all? Come up here, we'll check in and find Paul Leone, the president of the Breakers here.
Hi, sir. Welcome.
Hi there. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Good, thank you. Paul, how are you?
How are you?
Nice to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Thank you so much for the time. Paul, let's start where every conversation about the tourism industry starts for you, which is, how's the season been, and how's the next season going to be?
Yeah, we are coming off of the best season I can remember, actually, in the 28 years I've been here. And to bring it a little closer to home, a season that was better than our season in 2008 before the Great Recession started later that year.
Do you see this strength in business sustainable for the summer season for South Florida?
Yeah, our advanced bookings for the summer, both on the group side and on the leisure traveler side, tell me that this is going to continue, that this isn't just a blip. And we're looking forward to being sold out pretty much every weekend of the summer, and running probably 75% occupancies on average through the week.
Is there still a slow season in those warm, humid, and stormy summer months?
You know, I really don't think there is a slow season anymore in South Florida. And it sort of all makes sense now to me 28 years later living this, when you are along the coastline, even in the dead of summer here, and there is a nice breeze off the ocean, and you're in a bathing suit and taking a swim in the ocean or a pool, it's actually still quite pleasant.
You paint a good picture here for July in Palm Beach. But with that in mind, where is your summer business coming from? Is it coming from the U.S. or is it coming from foreign travelers?
Both domestically and internationally, and the number one domestic market for us through the summer is anywhere within a three-hour drive, say.
So it's Floridians that are coming to visit.
Absolutely. Florida is the most prominent market this time of year. For this customer, it's their getaway. I mean, they're going to splurge. So it brings them up a level in terms of spending.
So is how a staycation, a Floridian comes and spends money here, different than how somebody, say, from the Northeast visiting may spend money with your resort?
Yeah, I think the key difference is this idea that behaviorally, you know, how the customer behaves. I think these staycations are predominantly their key vacation of the year, and they're going to splurge.
So you're seeing more of your business come from a clientele that traditionally wouldn't be considered a tourist, per se, because they're from the region, right?
That's right. Yeah, I guess by traditional definition, we wouldn't call them tourists because they're so close to home.
Palm Beach has a reputation as a town for the 1%. How does that square with the clientele that you're seeing your business come from?
Well, Palm Beach, sure. Palm Beach has that that is characterized that way. But the fact of the matter is, throughout history, I mean, for a town that originated as a resort town, this is a very welcoming place. Listen, a customer is a customer is a customer.
You've been investing in this community for a long time, $250 million spent on this property in the last 10 years. You expect that kind of level of spending to continue, and how does that pay off for the community?
Breakers, the next 5 years, will spend on average $25 million maintaining and reinvesting in the property. The Breakers, being the biggest and most prominent business, has been a good example for these other businesses, not only had a positive effect on them, because our business, if our business grows, it will, you know, trickle down to them, but I think to serve as an example that, you know, even if you are successful and have a successful track record, you've got to continue to, you cannot stand still.
You are one of the largest employers in the community, about 1,500 employees. How do you see that changing as you're looking out 5 years and 10 years? Do you expect to be able to sustain that level or perhaps even increase?
Yeah, we for the first time in since 2008, we have begun to grow the workforce again. Our workforce is going to grow by probably 10% over the next couple of years.
Do you anticipate being able to find the qualified professionals that you need within the local labor market? Are you expecting perhaps to have to go outside to attract those folks here?
It would be a lot more efficient for us to be able to draw entirely from the surrounding area, South Florida. But we still find ourselves having to recruit nationally, even internationally. And I don't see that changing in the next few years. I'd like to see a change because we have some really good jobs. I think part of the challenge, Tom, for us is there are still a lot of entry-level workforce people who think that waiting tables or being an assistant manager in a restaurant is not necessarily a good job. And I think they're missing something in that perspective. These are really good jobs. The service industry is a growth industry. It is fueling the growth down here, especially the hospitality side. It's a pleasant business, and you make good money.
You know, that's an interesting point, Paul, because a lot of employers will look at that and say some of the entry-level jobs, they do have a tough time finding qualified people at the price point that they're willing to pay. Is that kind of essentially what you're saying in terms of the local workforce?
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah, I think getting them in the door, once they get in here, I think they realize this is a good industry.
So what would be your message to local leaders, local education leaders that are kind of on the front lines with that local entry-level workforce, that the message that you'd like to deliver to those folks that are local available labor but apparently are not showing interest in either the hospitality industry in general or specifically some of the opportunities here?
First of all, this is a solid business and a growth business. So even in a recessionary period, we employed 1,700 people. We were down from 2,000, but 1,700 jobs in the worst of it. Secondly, it's a really good working environment. And it's an industry that I think will continue to be successful to the extent that the pay and benefits, combination of pay, benefits, and working conditions, I think is actually, if you are open to this idea, where I think the point is that I think there's still a lot of people working off an old model. Mm-hmm. Like, why would I want to wait tables,
Right.
Or be a barback?
Are you able to go out and find a qualified worker outside of the local area at a lower price?
This is not going to be an excuse to pay less, because that's not my point. My point is, I think there's a misperception. These are really good-paying jobs, coupled with jobs, pay and benefits, coupled with a working environment, that this is a good industry.
What does a barback, beginning barback, make, or a waiter who comes in with some modicum of experience?
So let's assume, you know, a full-time employee. Let's use a waiter in a successful restaurant, which all of ours are successful. A waiter working full-time, can make $40,000 to $80,000 a year. I mean, depending on how many hours they want to work, they can go more than 40. How many tables they can handle. Some waiters can handle two tables at a time. Others can handle four. How good they are at upselling, right? And their service, how good their service is. You know, that's that. So the starting point at 40 is a good number. The 80, that's kind of my point. There's a range of opportunity there.
That's Paul Leone, the president of the Breakers Palm Beach, here on the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. He says some of those longtime waiters can, in fact, pull in six figures a year serving tourists here in South Florida. Join the conversation at WLRN.org. Use the hashtag Sunshine Economy on Twitter. Still to come on the program, tourism and gambling. Casinos support thousands of jobs and share millions, billions of dollars eventually with the state of Florida. We talk with the boss at Seminole Gaming.
When you think about Florida and you think about it being truly a family destination, you know, whether it be in Orlando or even just the tourism side of Fort Lauderdale, Miami, and Pompano Beach, and all the way up and down both coasts, I don't think there's an appetite for to have Florida be the Las Vegas of the East.
It's the Sunshine Economy, selling paradise, tourism in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson here on WLRN. Join the conversation, WLRN.org, on Twitter, at WLRN. Use the hashtag Sunshine Economy. Answer this question. You know you've seen a tourist in South Florida when? Well, we'll have more on that coming up. Now, one out of six of those passengers that are flying in and out of the Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood International Airport in April, they were customers of Ben Baldanza. Ben is the CEO of Spirit Airlines, and he joins us now here on the Sunshine Economy. Ben, your April traffic was down a little bit at Fort Lauderdale. Is that a sign of slower traffic to come?
We don't think so, Tom. Actually, it was down a little bit just because of seasonality, as you'd expect more people come fly, at least, to South Florida in a February than they might in an April or May. But some of that traffic will be back in July when many South American customers and Caribbean customers come here for vacations and such.
We heard earlier from the Breakers CEO that there really is no traditional slow season anymore in South Florida. Do your traffic patterns bear that out as well?
It does, and in fact, every year over the last number of years, we've seen a smoothing of the seasonality in South Florida. We believe that South Florida absolutely is a 12-month-a-year market today. There are cruises that depart every week from Everglades and Port of Miami. Mm-hmm. And so we've seen the business just in the time that I've been with Spirit since 2005 become much smoother through the year. There's still seasonality here, but it is much smoother.
How important is the cruise business to your traffic patterns at Fort Lauderdale?
It's pretty important. We carry a discretionary kind of traveler. At Spirit, we carry travelers who pay for the tickets themselves and who are deciding whether they take a trip or not, as opposed to someone telling them to take a trip. And
in other words, not a business traveler.
That's right.
Per se. This is a tourist. This is a vacationer. Usually,
that's right.
Yeah.
And a big reason that people come into South Florida is to not only enjoy our surf and sun, but to get on a cruise ship, since we operate two of the largest cruise ports in the world, yeah, in Miami and Fort Lauderdale. So it's important to the air traffic here is the cruise business, and so we stay closely aligned to the cruise business.
I want to talk more about your business model in a moment, but speaking as the CEO of Spirit Airlines, you've got a unique perspective to look at tourism traffic across your network, but also what your competitors are seeing. How does South Florida stack up in terms of a tourist destination, and what are competitors doing to try to attract that South Floridian visitor away from our region?
Well, it's an important piece of the tourism economy for the United States, of course. And because we tend to carry a discretionary traveler, meaning someone who's choosing to take the trip, it's an even more important part of Spirit's business. South Florida is our largest operational point. We carry more people in and out of South Florida than any other single point in our system. Mm-hmm. And so it's critically important to Spirit and Spirit's growth.
And where are you seeing most of your traffic come from in terms of coming to South Florida, coming to Fort Lauderdale International?
It really depends on time of the year. People go to and from New York all the time. Mm-hmm. People from south of here tend to come when at least the kind of traffic that we're carrying, meaning the family kind of traffic, tends to come when schools are out and things like that. There's a little more of that. Obviously, as you'd expect, more people come when the weather's even nicer here. As the man at the breaker said, it's nice all year, but as we all know, it's nicer sometimes of the year.
Yeah, it's in the 40s in the upper Midwest even today, and it's June. We should point that out here on the Sunshine Economy for South Florida on WLRN. Join the conversation on Twitter at WLRN. Use the hashtag Sunshine Economy. We are talking about selling paradise tourism in South Florida with the CEO at Spirit Airlines, Ben Baldanza. Ben, your model is called the ultra low cost model. Now, if we were to operate that way here, I'd have to charge you more for your headphones, charge you to turn on the microphone, charge you for the chair that you're sitting in, all those kinds of things. What are you hearing back from your customers and their ability to withstand the kind of a la carte pricing that Spirit has so successfully put in place in the market?
Well, you know, customers withstand that on a lot of the things they buy all the time. That's the way they buy cars. That's the way they buy food at restaurants. That's the way they buy a lot of things. The a la carte pricing is relatively new for the airline space, but it's not at all new in terms of consumer buying behavior. So I think it's more customers getting used to the fact that I pay as I go and I pay for the things that are important to me in an airline context when historically everything used to be bundled together. The customers who fly Spirit understand our model. When we look at DOT statistics, Department of Transportation statistics, we know that the customers who fly Spirit, that the total price they pay, the fare that they pay, plus the extras that they choose to buy, whether it's baggage or seats or things like that, that the total price they pay is less than their next best option on another airline. So they're fine because they're saving money, and that's why they choose us.
It's also led to a number of complaints for the Department of Transportation. The complaint rate for Spirit Airlines is traditionally higher than the complaint rate with some of the legacy. So is there a, you know, what's the business risk of this a la carte pricing that you're experiencing?
Or the reputational
risk for that matter.
We don't think it's that great. And I'm not trying to put my head in the sand by saying that. The reason we think it's not that great is that customers like to save money. And factually at Spirit, they do save money. You know, we carry about 1% of the traffic in the United States. And we're different than all the other airlines. So 99% of the commercial air travel is traveling under sort of a different kind of protocol or mm-hmm. paradigm where more things are included as opposed to a low upfront price and optional extras for everything else. So the fact that we're 1% on that end doesn't surprise me that government regulators and general people who report on the media would think of us as the outlier, mm-hmm. and that makes us look different. Mm-hmm. But we don't think it's a reputational risk because, again, the customers who are choosing us and increasingly repeating flying on us is because they spend less money doing it. You know, if you think about air travel, it's not an end in itself. Most people are on an airplane because they're going to do something. When they're at the breakers, they're on vacation. When they're getting to the breakers, they're mm-hmm. not on vacation yet. So the price elasticities are very different.
Is your biggest competitor Greyhound or Amtrak?
We think our biggest competitor is actually Best Buy or Amazon.com. And the reason is...
What do you mean by that? Because they're not selling airline seats.
No, they're not.
Not yet.
But what they are doing is they're trying to attract the extra dollars you have in your wallet that you can choose whether to spend or not.
The discretionary dollar.
You know, everybody's going to pay for their rent or mortgage. They're going to pay for their car if they have it. But when they have a little extra money and say, how am I going to spend it? Am I going to get the new refrigerator? Am I going to... Am I going to get this new great new book or something? Mm. Or am I going to go see grandma? Or am I going to go spend some time with the kids? That's really the tension for our customer base.
About 59 cents of every dollar in revenue comes from passengers. So 41 cents of every dollar in revenue in the last quarter came from what? Other fees? From all those baggage fees and seat fees. Is that right, Ben?
Yeah, most of it came from passengers as well, paying for extra services that aren't included in the ticket price, like baggage charges or seat assignment charges. Some of it came from third parties who pay to advertise on our planes. Mm-hmm. Some of it came from the bank that where we have an affinity relationship with our credit card. If you carry a Spirit credit card, you earn miles. The bank pays us. So it's from all those sources.
What's the next fee that Spirit Airline customers may face?
Well, you know, when it comes to unbundling, meaning separating out as a separate charge something that used to be included with your ticket price.
First it was checked baggage.
First it was checked baggage, then it was carry-on bags at Spirit, and now we charge to print your boarding pass at the airport, mm-hmm. although you can do it free at a kiosk. I won't say there's no other unbundling fees, but we're sort of at the limit of that. As we see growth in the non-ticket revenue line, which is what we call that 41% is the non-ticket, as we see growth in there, it's really from being able to offer more services to customers that were never originally included in your ticket price. For example, if when you check in, if we can get you a discount rate at the car park lot, mm-hmm. and that car park lot will give us a commission on mm-hmm. that would be revenue for us, but no one would have ever thought that was included in their ticket.
Right, and it may not be line-itemed as an a la carte fee as you go through the Spirit.com.
That's right. It'll just be an extra service that you can buy. You know, the more traditional things that customers buy are things like rental cars and hotels.
Sure. So if you're looking for that fee revenue as a source of your growth, I would imagine you're going to have to increase fees then for some of these a la carte items.
Well, we don't look at fee revenue as a source of revenue growth. And that's going to sound really odd to you, but mm-hmm. the industry has largely done that and has reacted really since 2008.
So you're saying you can't necessarily raise fees for checked baggage or to bring your baggage on the plane?
Well, we're saying that there's pressure in terms of the total price. We manage at Spirit, and our customers choose to fly Spirit because our total price point is lower. So as we have unbundled and as we've added charges for bags and seats and all kinds of things, we've also lowered our fare. Our fare's lowered over 23%. Mm-hmm. Over the last 5 years. Mm-hmm. And so it's been a trade-off. It's saying we'll charge you less if you behave in ways that cost us less by not bringing bags and things.
So the question that I'm sure you're hit with all the time, are you going to charge for bathrooms?
No, we're not going to charge for bathrooms. And the reason I think that even if you had our model, you might not charge me for the microphone.
For the headphones and microphone in the chair.
That's right. Is that our basic view is if it's necessary to take the trip, it's included in your base fare. If it's something you reasonably can make as an option, that you can say, I'll change my behavior and not have to use it, then we'll go ahead and charge it separately. We believe bathrooms are pretty necessary.
Economics are about incentives, and that's about behavior. There's no doubt about it. The CEO at Spirit Airlines, Ben Baldanza, along with us here on the Sunshine Economy, selling paradise tourism in South Florida. And still to come on the program, you know someone is a tourist in South Florida when?
When they have high white socks, short shorts, and are pointing at something rather uninteresting for a local.
This is the Sunshine Economy, selling paradise, tourism in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. The conversation ongoing on Twitter at WLRN using the hashtag Sunshine Economy and online at WLRN.org. You know you've seen a tourist in South Florida when? Well, tweet us those thoughts using the hashtag Sunshine Economy. Now, there's a multi-billion dollar question in the hospitality industry here in South Florida. What role do we want gaming to play in our tourism business? Well, Jim Allen is the chairman of Hard Rock International and the CEO of Seminole Gaming. He has headed up the tribe's gaming business for more than a decade and has led Hard Rock International since the Seminoles bought it in 2007. The tribe now runs 7 casinos in Florida. And after a slow beginning to this year, business is picking up.
We certainly, I think, experienced, like everybody else did in the United States, February was definitely soft. A lot of uncertainty, obviously, with gas prices and some of the new taxes that came into effect. I think as we look forward, we're still optimistic that, you know, South Florida and the properties over on the West Coast are still a great place to be.
What is driving your business for you for the rest of this calendar year, do you think?
Certainly what we see here in South Florida is a tremendous influx of people coming from Central and South America. So the more we can do to try to attract, that guest, that customer base to say, look, there's another option here. Just don't think of South Florida as South Beach. That's certainly a focus. But at the same time, a lot of our guests are repeat, business that comes from the South Florida area within an hour or 2 hours drive.
Is your biggest competitor South Florida itself? In other words, is it South Beach? Is it that kind of beach amenity is your biggest competitor?
I would say that just there's so many different options here that it's not necessarily just South Beach. But, Orlando is only, a 2.5-hour ride. Naples and the amazing, Southwest coast is, hour and a half. So Florida has a tremendous amount of attractions that become, I think, intriguing and interesting for one's palate.
That competition for his casinos extends to his local customers. Still, Allen says his hotel in Hollywood runs 98% full year-round. That pace of business has Allen looking for new opportunities to expand, and that's always a touchy subject when gambling is involved.
When you're talking about expanding the facility, are you talking about both the accommodations and the casino?
I think the first thing we need is more rooms, but certainly whenever you add more rooms, you would look at restaurants, you would look at retail, you'd look at the entertainment options, whether it be spas or some great, signature brands to be associated with an expansion. Then obviously, when that program is put together, then that will probably correlate to some additional gaming space. But we don't see a huge expansion of the gaming space here.
While reluctant to scope out any future plans to try and expand gaming, Allen says the Seminole Tribe has the financial power to build. In April, Moody's Investor Services upgraded the Seminole Tribe of Florida's corporate bond rating to investment grade. That means analysts think the tribe's financial condition is improving. But Seminole Hard Rock Entertainment has its own bond rating, and while improving, it continues to be considered a high-risk borrower. But before there is the need to pay for any expansion, Florida lawmakers would have to approve it, something they have not done. And not surprisingly, a full-tilt expansion of gaming in the Sunshine State is not something Allen supports.
When you think about Florida, and you think about it being truly a family destination, whether it be in Orlando or even just the tourism side of Fort Lauderdale, Miami, and Pompano Beach, and all the way up and down both coasts, I don't think there's an appetite for to have Florida be the Las Vegas of the East. I could be wrong, but certainly that's the way we view it. And the Seminoles have been here for a couple thousand years, so we operate under the tribe's sovereignty. But I don't think that, a huge expansion of gaming is something that would be beneficial for everybody involved.
Thanks to a 5-year deal with the state of Florida, the Seminole Tribe won't face any competition soon. The tribe makes monthly payments to the state under the agreement. In exchange, the tribe has the exclusive right to offer blackjack and other casino table games in Miami and Broward counties through 2015. That's when the 5-year exclusivity is due to expire.
If we knew that there was certainty to the scope, because certainly there's a question about the scope after 5 years or a potential expansion after 5 years, but if we knew the scope was certain, I think we'd be interested in discussing thousands and thousands and thousands of rooms.
It's tough not to use gambling terminology when talking about this high-stakes game of the business of gambling in the Sunshine State. After all, thousands of jobs and billions of dollars may be on the line. Now, the state holds the regulatory cards while the casinos hold the cash. The current bet the state has made is to guarantee limited competition for a cut of the gaming revenues.
I think we certainly would love to have a conclusion, to have an understanding as far as what is the scope. So if the state truly believes that there is a better option and putting casinos all over the state, then obviously the Seminole Tribe would no longer pay any revenue share. I think it's very difficult for an elected official, to evaluate the risk and the guarantee of an investment-grade company like ourselves, guaranteeing, we guaranteed $1 billion. I mean, nobody's ever done that in the history. So, it's a proven entity. It's a proven business. But frankly, it really doesn't matter what we think. It's really up to the elected officials of the state of Florida.
Is it one of the challenges that you face in terms of
that kind of business model, there's only one South Beach. You can't pick up and move South Beach. You can't add to the supply of South Beach or Orlando, for that matter, Disney World. There's only one of those. But, right, the casino, does it risk becoming a commoditized entertainment and tourism attraction?
I think that's a risk throughout the United States, you know, frankly. If you look at gaming, when I started in the industry in 79, you know, it was a real excitement to walk into a casino. It was like, wow, look at this. You know, it was exciting to go to a show and see a quote-unquote Las Vegas-style review. You know, gaming is, for all intents and purposes, in about 46 states, you know, throughout the United States in one form or another. So, you know, it's lost a little bit of the cachet.
Gaming can be a zero-sum game, essentially, between the house and the player. What about the industry? What do you think that means for the industry locally here and the impact that it has on the economy?
I think that overall it's been proven time and time again to create a lot of jobs, and jobs not just at entry level, jobs at professional level, PR people, advertising people, marketing people, technology people, accounting people. You know, if you think about the accounting staff, you know, that's involved in handling, you know, our gaming revenues exceed $2 billion, you know. So that's something that obviously is a tremendous financial responsibility to track all that. So there's a lot of jobs, and all those people, they then buy cars, they buy food, they buy groceries. And nobody, I think, that's fair and objective could dispute the ripple effect of not just gaming, because we, frankly, our brand, Hard Rock, is not just about gaming. It's truly about entertainment. You know, so if you have, I don't know, 25 restaurants in this complex, that's 25 chefs, you know, and all the different supports. So I think it's a positive.
Jim, let me ask you about the quality of the local workforce. You mentioned that Hard Rock has a ripple effect in the tens of thousands of jobs that it helps support through its direct business and indirect business. Are you finding the qualified workers in the local workforce that's necessary for the Hard Rock International growth plans that you have?
I think that, you know, as you know, we operate in 58 countries around the world. So we're probably one of the few organizations that really have a fair comparison or barometer. I would say that there's tremendous enthusiasm in the worker that is in, we'll call it the Florida marketplace. And certainly there is some differences between Tampa, you know, Naples, Fort Myers, Immokalee area, and we'll call it South Florida. Definitely there's differences. Mm-hmm. But with all that said, I think that what we find is the skill set is something that we're still teaching. There's certainly a lot more transient mentality, I think, in this particular state than what we see, say, in an operation, say, like in New York or some cities that have a little bit more historical, you know, I'm proud to be a doorman, you know, I'm proud to be a waiter in a gourmet restaurant versus, you know, I work in Aspen in the winter and I work in Florida or, you know, so people just kind of a little bit more transient in this market. And I think that we're always trying to increase and enhance the skill set and frankly the commitment to customer service.
For a long time, Jim, educational institutions here in the South Florida area have focused on hospitality as an industry. Mm-hmm. Is that kind of focus not working or not doing enough?
Oh, I think from an educational standpoint, it's fine. You know, I think certainly if you think about, you know, the great hospitality schools, obviously Cornell, Johnson & Wales, you know, and obviously they have a local campus. It's not so much the person that's graduating from the local curriculum, if you will. It's the person who says, you know what, I'm leaving the Northeast and I'm going to go to Florida. I'm going to be a bartender, you know, or I'm going to be a waiter, you know, or I'm going to be whatever, or I'm going to go now to Aspen, or I'm going to go. It's that transient mentality. Like you go to New York, there are people who are proud to be a doorman. They are proud. It's a great job. You know, so if you grow up being, you know, at first you're a bellman and then you're a house or a houseman and a bellman and then you become the doorman in a great hotel, that's something where, A, it's a great income, but it's certainly you're not just opening the door, you're really acting as a concierge, you're really acting as an ambassador as far as the overall marketing plan of the particular establishment that you work in.
Jim Allen there is the CEO at Seminole Gaming and the chairman at Hard Rock International here on the Sunshine Economy, Selling Paradise, Tourism in South Florida on WLRN. Asking the question on Twitter, you know you've seen a tourist in South Florida when? Well, Jane Miami tweets, when they have a Pacers t-shirt on. Certainly appropriate for this evening's big game. All right, still to come on our program, the cruise industry already huge and growing bigger. This is the Sunshine Economy, Selling Paradise, Tourism in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson here on WLRN. The two biggest ports of call in the cruise industry, right here in South Florida, Port of Miami and Port Everglades in Fort Lauderdale, outrank all other ports
not only nationwide, but globally, generating an estimated $1.1 billion of spending by passengers and crew. Anna Sampson covers the travel business for the Miami Herald and joins us here on the Sunshine Economy. It's been a tough couple of years in terms of crew safety. You had the, of course, fatal grounding of the cruise ship off the coast of Italy, and then, of course, most recently, the fire on a Royal Caribbean ship. What is the state of safety and safety review in the cruise industry?
It's those two events kind of have bookended a very difficult stretch for the industry, and I think there have been a lot of questions raised. People were saying after the Costa Concordia incident, well, you know, this kind of thing is never going to happen again. This was such a crazy, fluky incident. But then there started to be, there was a fire on a Carnival ship in February, the Carnival Triumph. And then there were these spate of other mechanical issues on other Carnival ships, and people started saying, well, you know, this isn't fatal, thank God, but this is raising a lot of questions. And then the Royal Caribbean fire was just kind of another twist, because the previous ones had all been Carnival ships, and people were saying, oh, well, maybe the problem is Carnival. But here's this incident on another cruise line. They've been pretty widely praised for their handling of this event.
Royal Caribbean has.
Royal Caribbean has.
Right.
Unlike Carnival, which took a lot of flack post some of their problems. But, you know, it really has hit profits. It's really hit reputation. And it's hard to measure the impact on potential cruisers who are not going to go on their first trip now.
Is there something at risk in terms of South Florida being the cruise capital of the world as these safety questions continue to be asked?
What really happens is that cruise ships don't go out empty. So they will continue to fill their ships, but they'll do so at the expense of the cruise fare. So they'll find that sweet spot where they lower the price enough to attract the passengers they need to go out for a week in the Caribbean. But the real hit is to the bottom line for the cruise companies, which, you know, are major economic players in South Florida.
Yeah, huge economic interests here in South Florida. And what about the investments that they're making, not only in safety, but the investments in the infrastructure that we're seeing at Port of Miami to accommodate ever larger and ever growing cruise industries?
So there's a couple of different things. The investments in safety that they're making are not insignificant. Carnival alone has recently announced as much as $700 million to upgrade its entire fleet worldwide for fixes related to fire safety and reliability. In case they do go without power at sea, they'll have enough backup power to keep guests comfortable. So that's $700 million just for that. But then you have South Florida ports, Port Everglades and Port Miami, as you mentioned, two of the biggest in the world. And they have invested millions and millions of dollars in upgrades to terminals for to keep the ships coming to their ports. Miami talks about long-term, you know, hundreds of millions to upgrade and to be able to accommodate some of the biggest ships that are sailing right now, which don't currently come to Miami.
This begs the question, though, is the cruise industry building toward too much capacity? In other words, right, Hanna, is there going to be demand for all of these thousands of cabins that are going to be put on the seas and are going to disembark here in Miami and in Port Everglades in the years ahead?
Well, they're dealing with that in different ways. So we've seen over the last few years, North American cruise lines, which were kind of Caribbean focused at the outset, really spreading their wings, not really, but really spreading out around the world.
Right.
So you've got deployment in Australia, you've got deployment in Asia that increases every year, and that exposes them to new levels of risk and questions about, you know, can they really tweak the product to fit those markets, and do they risk saturation in those markets? But it does kind of ease the pressure on Miami.
Mm-hmm.
They've also slowed down the production of new ships considerably.
Yeah, absolutely. We got to leave it there with the cruise industry. Hanna Sampson covers it for the Miami Herald. Still to come, socks with sandals, lobster red skin. What is a tourist in South Florida?
Greater Fort Lauderdale.
A great place to visit.
We make Florida shine.
It's the greatest.
We'll be right back. And this is the Sunshine Economy, selling paradise, tourism in South Florida. Most of us living and working here recognize the benefits, obviously, of playing host to a constant stream of visitors. Tourism, after all, as we've heard over the last hour, is an awfully big engine to our economy. But it really begs the question, what is a tourist? Seems an innocuous question with an obvious answer, right? But think about it. Business of tourism continues growing and growing more complex. So does who we consider tourists.
Here we have our finishing department. We have 8 people in finishing that actually finish the garments after
Jason Loeb is walking through his dry cleaning headquarters in Miami Beach. You may not think Jason's business sees many tourists. He is the president of Sudsy's Dry Cleaners and Laundry. He has dozens of people washing, ironing, sorting, and cleaning the laundry his blue and yellow vans pick up from Plantation to Pinecrest. Now, he doesn't work with hotels, but still, he figures about 20% of his business comes from customers he considers tourists.
We deal with the tourism-based industry where people come here and spend a month and then leave town and come back on a monthly basis, and they're here maybe 4 or 5 months in the season. We have seen a tremendous impact of that business. South Florida has a large amount of that type of tourism right now, people from all over the world.
Some of the clothes under the steam irons at Sudsy's on Miami Beach may have come through these doors at Damiani Italian Clothing for Men on South Dixie Highway near Dadeland Mall. Again, not an obvious business with tourist customers, but it's all in how you define a tourist. Co-owner Carmine Camara credits half of his business to international travelers, especially those who could be considered here on working vacations.
What really drives all the retail operation in South Florida are the business people of South America. They also have Miami as the center for the business, as the hub. It's more of a business interaction, and of course, at the same time, then they take some time. Besides doing all their business, they have a good time, maybe with their family, and they do purchasing and whatever.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Bagging from American Airlines, flight 13.
Odds are those international tourists, whether you consider them official tourists or not, began their South Florida journey here. More than 25 million passengers per year come through the North Terminal at Miami International Airport. Most of them are customers of Marilyn DeVoe.
Our tourists are those that are going strictly for pleasure.
She is the vice president of airport services at American Airlines in Miami.
So, you know, I'm going to go sit on a beach, or I'm going to go to Orlando, to Disney World, to enjoy time with my family and friends.
So her definition of a tourist is what we would traditionally think of. Someone here for a few days, pure pleasure, probably sunburned after a couple of days at the beach. When we asked our Public Insight Network how to spot a tourist, that was a common answer.
When you see that they've been at the beach in January.
When they have high white socks, short shorts, and are pointing at something rather uninteresting for a local.
But Patrick DiCarlo from Biscayne Park has a more thoughtful description, maybe a warning of sorts, about tagging labels on visitors who are responsible for such an important piece of our economy.
You know someone's a tourist in South Florida when you catch yourself overgeneralizing with mostly classist, racist, elitist, and regionalist caricatures of people during Art Basel, Urban Beach Week, Ultra, and any beach-going day during the winter.
Join that conversation on Twitter at WLRN, hashtag Sunshine Economy. You know you've seen a tourist in South Florida when? Well, according to Jane Miami, they have a Pacers T-shirt on. Next Monday here on the Sunshine Economy, the promise of technology and startups.
I am convinced that we can actually make Miami, South Florida, actually, a technology hub, right? A real technology hub. As much as we want to be, we're not.
That's Manny Medina, the former CEO at technology services giant Terramark. He's among those leading a new charge to ignite technology, specifically in South Florida, and startups in general. It's next Monday's Sunshine Economy, Silicon Beach, the future of technology and startups here in South Florida. Finally, the only way to truly appreciate our uniqueness is really to become tourists ourselves and contribute to an economy someplace else. It could be as simple as visiting a new neighborhood or trekking across the globe. Only then we understand why others want to share in our sunshine.
I wish every day the sun would shine. Take me to another place in my life. Everything is beautiful.
no sun.